The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Today, we are joined by two former Federal Reserve officials to get their take on Bernanke's plan. On the phone, Gary Stern, former president and CEO of the Minneapolis Fed, and Randy Krosner. He's a professor at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business and a former Fed governor. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good morning.
Greetings.
Great to have you both. So, Gary, let's start with you. We've got a lot of specific questions, but generally speaking, where is the Fed now? What do they signal? What do you think of what they're doing?
Well, I actually think they're right on course because I think the economic news over the last 12 months has been more positive than anticipated. It hasn't been wildly more positive, but more positive than anticipated. The labor market is clearly improving. Consumer spending looks pretty good. Housing is doing better, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that it's the right time to be seriously thinking about dialing back QE3 and when that program may terminate and so forth. And I think what the chairman indicated in the statement and in his comments was, you know, not at all surprising, although obviously it created quite a market reaction, which is, of course, a somewhat different matter. But as I said, I think the Fed is on course given the way developments here and abroad are evolving.
Randy?
Yeah, I would very much agree with what Gary said. The way I've been characterizing things is the economy is in kind of a sideways slide, we are seeing positive job growth, a painfully slow decline in the unemployment rate, but continued growth, no double dip and nothing going gangbusters. The Fed was concerned about a swoon again, and so that's why it undertook the new round of asset purchases. But it's unclear what the efficacy of these are going forward. Starting to think about pulling back now makes sense. Also, I think it was very sensible to start doing this in advance of when they would actually start to pull the punch bowl away. As I think I've discussed with you before, it's the open mouth operations, not just the open market operations, the purchases and sales of securities, that seem to have just as much impact, if not more impact, on the markets. And kind of pre-testing what the impacts would be on where the economy is going to move will help them to calibrate how quickly they should unwind.
Well, did the market make the right move then, Randy, or is this an overreaction?
Well, I agree with Gary that I thought the Fed was pretty clear about their direction, and that this, you know, that sometime in the next year they would be pulling back. But I think whenever there's a change in the communication, a change in the open mouth operation, the market gets a little bit worried about this, and I think it's good to sort of get this out of the way now. Also, I think part of this is a little bit of not just the Fed's exit strategy, but Ben Bernanke's exit strategy, wanting to kind of get this on the table, get the removal of the additional stimulus in train before he may hop on a train to somewhere outside Washington.
Well, you know, Gary and Randy. Very important also, though, to look at Jim Bullard, president of St. Louis Fed, his dissent, which he clarified a note they put out because he dissented. He said, look at inflation. He talks about the inappropriate timing of Ben Bernanke's statements. He also says that the announcement of an appropriate timeline for reducing the QE program to zero was a step away from state contingent monetary policy. Do you agree? Let's start with you, Gary.
Not really. I don't agree because I think the entire Fed statement is conditional on how the economy and inflation perform from here. So I don't agree with that part of it. As far as the merits of the case, inflation obviously has been running a bit below the Fed's 2% target, but somehow it doesn't strike me as appropriate for central bankers to worry about inflation coming in a little too low. I mean, after all, price stability is an important objective. Having said that, you know, if you really thought you were in for a bout of significant deflation, I don't mean a little bit of deflation. I mean, you know, rapidly and substantially declining prices, that would be a different matter. But I don't know that anybody has a forecast that encompasses that with any kind of reasonably high probability, nor do I. And we should remember that there's a lot of inertia in the inflationary process. So that if inflation is running at 1% or 2% for some time, it's likely to keep running at 1% or 2% for some time further. I don't see that as a major concern myself.
In about 15 seconds, Randy, you want to take a swipe at that?
Sure, I think I'd agree with Gary. I mean, I think we do need to be concerned about anything that might be leading to deflation, but we don't see that in terms of inflation expectations. When we were in the fall of 2008 and early 2009, inflation expectations had gotten very low, even by some measures, negative. And that's when you really need to act.
It's a very unusual thing to have somebody dissent with a statement just a couple of days after an FOMC statement and press conference, isn't it? Let's start with you, Gary.
Yeah, that's unusual, but I do think it's worthwhile to clarify your position if you somehow thought the message got muddled or didn't come across the way you intended. So I don't have any problem with the clarification side of it. I do think that on the substance of the dissent, you know, it seemed to me that there's a bit of grasping at straws, I guess is one way I would put it, in the sense that I personally don't share some of those concerns.
Well, Randy and Gary, but the Fed set up a structure here. And again, this has been sort of ad hoc, right? The Fed has been developing this policy as it goes. But 6.5% on unemployment and 2.5% on inflation as, you know, thresholds. But doesn't it also have an inflation level it's supposed to defend? And isn't that what Jim Pollard is raising, the number one? In fact, fundamentally, how can you start even talking specifically about tapering off when inflation is actually falling, it's getting lower, and you just marked down your GDP forecast? I mean, how can you talk about it now? He said it was inappropriately timed. I mean, maybe it's technical. Maybe he's being a little bit nitpicky, but if you're trying to figure out what the Fed's doing, isn't this important, Randy?
Well, certainly the outlook on inflation is very important, both on the upside and the downside. And they did lower their forecast for the short-term inflation rate, but the intermediate and longer-term forecasts have remained around the same. And they actually they seem to have a view that things will get stronger next year. So I think it's important for the Fed to be looking forward, not just looking backward, and looking not just over a few month time horizon, but a longer time horizon. Obviously, the majority of Bullard's colleagues around the table think that inflation is not going to get too low, is going to come back, and the economy is going to come back reasonably strongly. I think reasonable people can disagree, and I think it's perfectly fine to have a different point of view. And I actually think that's useful for the Fed, for people to see that there is real discussion both on the upside of inflation and downside of inflation. I think that actually helps to anchor expectations.
Well, and of course, he has called himself the North Pole of inflation hawks. What about the idea that he was complaining about the calendar nature of it, that the Fed was tying it to sort of certain months and that it was just being very telegraphed?
Well, I think they were trying to move away from the calendar approach by a few months ago giving specific economic criteria, as you mentioned, 2.5% and 6.5% with respect to inflation and unemployment, and now the chairman in his press conference saying that they'll start to give an unemployment threshold for their wind down of the asset purchase program. I think it's much better to do it in terms of concrete economic variables, because that's really what the motivating factors are for the Fed decision making, not just some arbitrary calendar date.
Gary, let me give you a question from a listener asking if perhaps when you look at the thresholds on the unemployment side, is 6.5% unemployment too high? After all, Gary Stern was there when Alan Greenspan, former Fed chairman, let the unemployment rate fall to 3.9%, and there was no inflation.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think it's important to bear in mind that 6.5% is a threshold number. It's not a target. I think the Fed would certainly welcome and hope for an unemployment rate that gets significantly below that over the course of the current business expansion. And in fact, I think if it turns out to be a reasonably long-lived expansion, it will get significantly below 6.5%. I think that 6.5% pertains to the degree of monetary policy stimulus or accommodation that the Fed wants to provide. And after all, as Randy just noted, the Fed does have to be forward-looking. You don't want to wait until inflation is a here-and-now problem before becoming less accommodative. And if you believe, as the Fed does, in kind of a gap model of inflation, that is, when there's a lot of excess capacity in the economy, a large output gap, inflation will be low, but as the gap diminishes, inflation may accelerate, and that's their basic view. You can't wait till the gap gets very, very small to change policy. And we should bear in mind that, you know, the Fed, I think, is working very hard to prepare financial market participants for basically what most people thought was inevitable anyway, which is an end of QE3 and an increase in short-term interest rates. Now, all of that is still some time off. All of that is still state contingent or conditional. But they do want to prepare market participants, and obviously that's getting underway.
Well, Gary, let me ask you, would the Fed chairman be pleased then with the market reaction? Because we have seen a backup in yields, pretty significant. In fact, it was called violent a couple of times on our air. But also seemingly a capping of sort of equity froth for now, at least.
I'm not sure I would use the word pleased, but I don't pretend to be a mind reader. I would say that the Fed would probably prefer a less violent reaction than what we have observed over the last couple of days. But, you know, on the other hand, if some of the violence dissipates over the next week or so, they'll probably be a lot more comfortable. I would think they would prefer that the adjustment occur, but it occur in a much more orderly way.
And in fact, Randy, Ben Bernanke said he was puzzled at the bond market's reaction after he opened the doors pretty definitively to tapering off at some point on May 22nd.
Yeah, I think the Fed had made it clear that this wasn't really QE infinity. It was going to be there until we had sustainable recovery in the job market. I think it's very helpful now that rather than using that more vague term, sustainable recovery, the chairman has at least in his oral remarks, said that means the vicinity of 7%. My hunch is that in the next FOMC statement, it'll be a little bit more concrete.
Right.
And I think that's very helpful to give concrete economic benchmarks rather than either times like 2015 or more vague terms like sustainable labor market recovery.
Gentlemen, I want to get in a question on banking from another listener asking, let's start with you, Gary, if you think the regulators are using the living wills, this is how a bank has to lay out how it would be shut itself down or be shut down if it becomes insolvent. If its living wills are being used to properly restructure banks into simpler, more resolvable institutions, what's your view?
As a matter of fact, right now, I think the answer to that question is no. But I do think living wills properly used could certainly work in that direction. For my nickel, the living wills or resolution recovery plans are the most important part of the Dodd-Frank legislation from a too-big-to-fail perspective, that is, reining in too-big-to-fail. And in preparation, not only are living wills important tools from a regulatory point of view, but if I were part of senior management or a board of directors at one of these large, complex financial institutions, I would use the preparation of living wills to very, very thoroughly review in a very disciplined way what lines of businesses we're in, what geographic locations, who our counterparties are, what's the shape of our funding, with a view towards, what should we really be doing and what doesn't pass a risk-reward test. And where the test isn't passed, I would certainly be trying to exit those lines of businesses, those activities, those geographic areas.
Randy, you want to weigh in that too?
Sure. I would agree that this is something that is in principle valuable. In practice, we haven't gotten there yet. One of the things that that I think we really saw in the financial crisis is the uncertainty about how contracts would be dealt with when the crisis comes. Many people had been dealing with highly rated financial institutions. They just didn't want to have to think about that. There was just too much legal uncertainty out in the shadows. And then suddenly they were faced with these issues. They didn't know how counterparty risk would be resolved. They didn't know what would happen if a large financial institution got into trouble. And that's when people pull back. This is one of the reasons why in emerging market countries we talk about the rule of law. Countries that don't have rule of law, people don't invest in them. In some sense, during the crisis, we became a little bit like those emerging market countries with very unclear property rights. And when people don't know how their contracts will be treated, they pull back. So if we can have more clarity, and if the living wills can help with that, and along with the resolution processes from the FDIC, they really need to clarify what they will do with a new orderly resolution authority. That can be helpful. But so far, I don't think we've gotten there.
Can I get a quick reaction from both of you on what's happening in emerging markets and how much the Federal Reserve is watching that and concerned about it? We're seeing so much weakness across so many currencies and bond markets and even equity markets across the globe. Gary, let's start with you.
Well, the Federal Reserve is certainly aware of it because one of the things the Fed is very good at is gathering and analyzing information not only domestically but globally. So they're certainly aware of it. Obviously, you know, the Fed is a domestic institution, and there is nothing the Fed can really do about it in any direct, active way. To the extent that, that there's consultations and so forth, I have no doubt that that is occurring. But I don't. I'm not sure that all of this is terribly surprising. Take China, for example. You know, most developing countries, even those that are developing rapidly and have been pretty successful, sooner or later run into a period of financial distress. If you look at the history across the globe of these experiences, and so you know, while it's by no means comforting, it's by no means positive. I don't think it's very surprising that.
And quickly, Randy, we just have a few seconds left.
Sure. I think on China, there's a lot of uncertainty about where the regime wants to go with growth, how much they're willing to forego growth to try to get things on a more stable, sustainable path, maybe on a lower growth path. And I think that's part of what's been generating the uncertainty over the last few days, because we've been getting some very mixed signals out of China.
Randy Krosner, thank you so very much. Former Fed Governor, also from the Booth School of Business. Gary Stern, former President, Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Thank you both for joining us on the Hayes Advantage, Bloomberg Radio.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.